It is 1 p.m. here in the city of Kingston, and you are tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, or perhaps via CFRC.ca. We broadcast from Lower Carruthers Hall on beautiful Queen's University campus. I'm Jesse Bell, and this is your afternoon news brief. Let's kick things off with your City of Kingston traffic report. Ontario Street from Brock to Clarence will be closed August 7th from 7 a.m. until August 9th at 6:30 p.m. for the poker run. Wright Crescent at Palace Road to Palace Road is closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic calming features on Wright Crescent. Norman Rogers Drive from Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard to Van Order Drive is still closed to through traffic to facilitate roadway rehabilitation and configuration improvements. The City of Kingston and Utilities Kingston are still in the midst of their reconstruction of Princess Street. This major infrastructure project includes upgrades to underground and above ground utilities, as well as improvements to enhance safety and comfort for pedestrians and cyclists. Berry Street to Queen is still closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is still closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Moving now to your Environment Canada weather report. The forecast for Wednesday, August 5th, we've got a 27-degree high with sunny conditions all day, 30% chance of precipitation overnight as the temperature drops down to 19 degrees. That's a wrap for your afternoon news brief. Coming up next, we have CFRC's Community Takeover series hosted by Aaron McCauley.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario since 1922. Find and follow us on Instagram at CFRC Music. Coming up in this special community takeover of our airwaves, we're featuring speakers from Emancipation Day in Kingston, which took place in Confederation Park on Saturday. Since 2021, Emancipation Day has been observed annually on August 1st, commemorating the enactment of the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833 across the British Empire. The day reflects a shared civic commitment to honoring the resilience of Black and Indigenous communities, acknowledging the legacy of enslavement in Canada, and advancing education, reflection, and collective liberation. The day hopes to encourage Canadians to reflect on the ongoing struggle for equality and continue the work of dismantling racial discrimination in Canada. Please note that this event was held outdoors and in front of a fountain, so the sound quality is impacted, but we believe the messaging is worth sharing.
Pleasure to invite J.C. Kenny, who is one of the leaders of the City of Kingston, to offer our land acknowledgement and welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. It's such a privilege to be here. And as Kibo said, let's start with acknowledging we are gathered here on the traditional lands of the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and the Huron-Wendat peoples. We recognize these lands as the enduring home of many diverse First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. We honor the original stewards of this land and their deep, ongoing connection to the past, present, and future. As we gather to mark Emancipation Day, we reflect on the interconnected histories of Indigenous and Black communities. We recognize the legacies of colonialism and slavery, and they continue to shape experiences today, and that the work of truth, justice, and reconciliation remains ongoing. Today is a time to honor resilience, celebrate freedom, and commit ourselves to building a more just and equitable future for everyone. I loved what Pauline sang about freedom. That was beautiful. On this special occasion, we gather here to celebrate who we are, to acknowledge every one of us here, people who have taken time out of busy lives, and in some cases, just the daily challenges of living, which can be overwhelming. To be here on the beautiful waterfront in Kingston and in front of Kingston City Hall to honor and mark Emancipation Day, with particular attention, as Kibo talked about, to this year's theme, honoring the past, empowering the future. Emancipation Day, as we've heard this morning, marks a time in history when the British Parliament abolished some 250 years of slavery of people of African descent. And for all of our awareness here today, it was first officially recognized by the Canadian government in 2021. It wasn't supported, it was just officially recognized as Emancipation Day, 2021. Here in Kingston, City Council asked that the marking of Emancipation Day be continued in 2022 and beyond, which is why we're here today. As, quote, a reminder of Canada's history of enslaving people of African descent as well as Indigenous peoples. And although we can acknowledge that many gains have been made, I think we can also agree that people of black and brown skin and other equity-deserving groups still face discrimination, if not in all, then in some corners of their lives. Racism is alive and well, and each of us is called upon to do our part, to do what we can to quash it at the root, to call it out when we see it, to recognize racism for what it is. This is not an easy task. We live in a world where the tendrils of racism can be found in our own modern institutions, healthcare, policing, education, housing. Big one in Kingston, housing. We're dealing with that a lot, the inequities in housing, and trying to fix it. And that's to name just a few. And of course, it can be very subtle, sometimes coming in the form of small aggressions. You can't quite put your finger on it, but it's no less deadly and hurtful. Have we progressed? We have. We no longer see our ancestors in physical chains, but the chains of racism and discrimination can appear in many forms. We live next to a country where many of the programs built carefully and implemented around equity, diversity, and inclusion in corporations, school boards, companies, governments, and so on, have been dismantled over the past year or so, with those in leadership who once embraced, supported, and promoted these programs now threatened with consequences if they even try to discuss and teach ideas around equity and inclusion. The term redistricting, you've heard it. It's become commonplace over the past year or so in news reports. What it means is that in some districts of the southern United States, efforts to reduce black representation have been very successful. Voters in some districts will be unable to put their votes behind black candidates who they believe would have advocated for their interests. In the year 2026, there are serious and legitimate concerns. The clock is moving backwards. And the struggle by black people and other disenfranchised groups to see the Voting Rights Act of 1965 seems like a lot of work a long time ago. It's actually going by the wayside in favor of white supremacy. In this country, therefore, it is of utmost importance that groups such as those working in Kingston and beyond continue the work with diligence and focus. The Anti-Racism Working Group, doing such good work. It's a group of council, of city council. And the office that has been part of this municipality since 2022, also with the full support of city council, and it focuses exclusively on matters of equity, diversity, inclusion, indigeneity, LGBTQ plus and accessibility. Critical, critical they stay the course and not waver. In an era where it would be easy to follow the trend, this disturbing trend, and put the focus elsewhere on other matters across the community. Let us not forget, there are those who practice overt racism in plain view. Gangs such as the Proud Boys that are vocal and celebrate overt racism against people of color. We'd like to believe this type of activity happens elsewhere, not on our shores, but that thinking is dangerous. In the past year, for instance, we're hearing increasingly more about martial arts clubs in Canada, in Ontario, where white nationalists prepare for violence. Investigations reveal these groups are part of a decentralized neo-Nazi network that has grown, not shrunk, grown globally in recent years. They exist in our towns and cities. And it's important we recognize this is our reality. This is here. In a country where we'd like to think of ourselves as open and inclusive, there's work to do. Racism isn't natural, it's learned. We don't see it in our children. It is learned. And what is learned can be unlearned. First step is to recognize discrimination for what it is. Know it when we see it, call it out. More importantly, call it in. Ask why they feel the way they do and challenge those beliefs. They're here among us. They exist. All of us here today have not just an individual responsibility to call out racism, but also to advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves, to bring attention to those indifferences that destroy the quality of life for those less fortunate. Kingston has long been thought of as a largely white community. But the demographic is changing. We see it in the streets, we see it downtown, in the university district, in a growing number of neighborhoods, all through this beautiful community, urban and rural. The range of different backgrounds, colors, and languages I found was very evident during the FIFA celebration a few weeks ago, which we attended. I'm sure a lot of you did as well. In this very area, right around City Hall, so many backgrounds. It was really beautiful to see. We are a changing community, and that means all of us need to be mindful of what actions we ourselves are taking against racist behaviors and ideologies. The word belonging is enshrined in the city's mission, vision, values. Belonging. We need to practice that word in all we do. And it bears mentioning that Kingston has a very rich history of black families settling, dating back to the 1800s. People who lived right along this street here. Sincere appreciation to Stones Kingston, by the way. They have an online digital exhibit and social history. Pauline, you would know about this, a lot of you would. The Queen's University Archives, and gratitude to them for researching and collecting these important accounts, in many cases from people in the area who themselves have made sure these histories are not lost. Joseph George, it's an important name, came from Pennsylvania in 1842 to visit his brother on Wolf Island and decided to stay. Who wouldn't? Beautiful community. His business, listed as Builders and Contractors, was located on Wellington Street. Long before that, black slaves who deserted during the American Revolution to join the British were granted their freedom. Some were landing here in what was much later called Kingston, and elsewhere in what was then Upper Canada, later to be Ontario. When slavery was officially abolished throughout the British colonies, fugitive slaves from the southern United States, that would be the southern United States that we talked about already this morning, they fled in droves across the border, with numbers increasing through the 1830s and 40s. Other important names in Black history, George Mink, you may have heard that name, a prominent resident who had an enslaved father. He owned hotels and other properties here, and at one point was nominated to be on the local council of the day. William Johnson, he's the earliest Black entrepreneur documented in the community. He came from Ohio around 1826. He was a successful barber and hairdresser. Many of us in this audience would appreciate that. And he built what they're calling a handsome home on Earl Street, which has kind of been noted in the archives as proof that Black people have long been part of the mainstream. And we continue to prosper, as those early Black families did, because although we're not a monolithic group, we operate with a collective and unspoken resilience. And so on this Emancipation Day 2026, we find ourselves wondering, will this ever stop? Will the journey ever end? And will we reach full equality among the races? What we can say is that events such as Emancipation Day are important, as are other occasions, such as Black History Month, and all the days and months set aside to honor different cultures, religions, genders. Each of us has a responsibility to continue advocating for ourselves and for those who, for whatever reason, are unable to do so, to celebrate our achievements and our very existence. And to do so with grace and love and understanding. As former American First Lady Michelle Obama said in her amazing speech, which I'm sure most of us saw during the opening of the Obama Center in Chicago this past June, quote, "It's about seeing each other and showing up for each other, regardless of messages and trends that we might be aware of. To the contrary." This day is also made up of some remarkable and talented people from the Kingston community who will have an opportunity of meeting today. I'm going to hand the mic back to Kibo, speaking of incredibly talented people. Thank you so much, Kibo, for what you're doing today, for doing it in both official languages. And we honor all the languages that are represented here today. And thank you so much, everybody, for being here. And I wish you all a meaningful and memorable Emancipation Day. Thank you.
It is my great pleasure to welcome our keynote speaker for today's ceremony, Keisha Facey. Keisha Facey is a senior leader in Ontario's child welfare sector, currently serving at the Ontario Association of Children's Aid Societies, where she provides strategic oversight to provincial learning and equity initiatives. She leads work across sector-wide capacity building and One Vision, One Voice, advancing race equity and system transformation for Black children, Black youth, and families. With a strong foundation, organizational learning and systems change, Keisha has led the development of large-scale training strategies, governance education, and knowledge mobilization efforts that reach thousands of practitioners and leaders across the province. Her work is grounded in bridging policy, practice, and lived expertise to drive meaningful and measurable change. Beyond her sector leadership, Keisha is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, where her research focuses on Black communities' interactions with historically inequitable systems. She's also the principal of Keisha Facey Group, where she provides strategic advisory on equity and support, strategic advisory support on equity, policy, and organizational change. A compelling and thoughtful speaker, Keisha brings a unique blend of strategic insight, lived perspective, and a deep commitment to equity, making her a powerful voice on leadership, systems change, and community-centered transformation. As we welcome Keisha, we will first hear the song Zimbabwe by Bob Marley. Oh.
Inviting me here to the event today. And what I love most about being able to travel around the country and learn about the different Black communities that exist is that I get to hear from people that are leading the work. So JC, I didn't have any clue that I was going to be hearing from you today, and it was fantastic. I learned so much about the city of Kingston, and I felt so much pride. As you were talking, I said to my husband, I don't think I need to go. I don't think I have anything else to say, right? Like, everything's been covered. So bear with me if there's some repetition. That just means we're in sync, and that's exactly what this is about, right? It's about collective struggle. And there's so many of us who don't know each other, but are feeling the same things and experiencing the same fight, right? And we all ultimately want the same things in the end, which is joy and liberation, and particularly for the young people that are coming up after us. So, as I mentioned, it's truly an honor to be with you here today as we commemorate a day that belongs not simply to history, but to all of us who continue the work of freedom. You're coming to help me. You see me struggling, right? Okay. Thank you. I was trying. So I'm really grateful that we got to begin with the words of Bob Marley. That song actually was written in 1979, which is the same year that I was born. And in 1980, Bob Marley stood before thousands of people in what was then the newly liberated nation of Zimbabwe. And when he sang, "Every man got a right to decide his own destiny," So when arm in arms with arms, we'll fight this little struggle, because that's the only way we can overcome our little trouble. Marley was singing about Zimbabwe's independence, but he was also singing about something much larger. He was singing about the struggle that had stretched across centuries, a struggle carried across oceans, a struggle that linked Africa to the Caribbean to Canada, and Canada, obviously, to communities like Kingston. And that struggle continues today, because our struggle has never simply been about freedom. It has always been about humanity, about dignity, about belonging, which was mentioned today, about our collective right to imagine and build a future that is not defined by the violence that has been imposed upon us, a right to heal from the pain of the past. Today, as we commemorate Emancipation Day, I want us to think about liberation, and Black liberation specifically, and not thinking about it as the absence of change. I want you to think about it in terms of the presence of joy. There was a moment as I was sitting there were some little ones running. I know everybody saw them. They were super cute. There's about four of them. They were wearing matching t-shirts. I think there were some beads and some braids, and they just exuded all of the joy that we all want to always keep with us. And I saw maybe one was going to jump in the water, and I was saying, jump. I was saying, do it. Go in the water. It's a hot day. I was hopeful for that. But that's what we're talking about when we think about liberation. You know, we want communities that are able to determine our own future. You know, we think about economic self-reliance, political voice, institutional power, safe communities, healthy families, children who grow up knowing exactly who they are or where they want to be, the freedom to imagine beyond survival, and maybe most importantly, the ability to live without fear. Jump, right? Jump in the water, no fear. So wherever you're commemorating, it could be Haiti's liberation, you know, that happened in 1804 as the first Black Republic, or it could be Emancipation Day that we're celebrating today, you know, that made the coming into the force of the Slavery Abolition Act on August 1st, 1834, which freed more than 800,000 enslaved people across the British Empire, including in Canada and the Caribbean, or whether you observe Juneteenth, recognizing the final enforcement of the abolition of slavery in the United States in 1865, or whether you're here to celebrate the independence movement that swept across the African continent throughout the 20th century. These commemorations are connected by a shared struggle for freedom, dignity, self-determination, and sovereignty. Regardless of where your roots lie, they remind us that the pursuit of liberation has taken many paths, but has always been driven by the enduring resistance, courage, and resilience of Black people. And so, liberation asks us, what does it truly mean to be free? Because emancipation was never the end of the story. It wasn't like emancipation happened, and therefore, here you are, you're free. It was actually the beginning of another chapter. There's an Akan principle from Ghana known as Sankofa. Are we all familiar with Sankofa? I'm hoping by now most people are familiar with Sankofa. You are familiar? All right, so you let me know how I do. So essentially, Sankofa teaches us that we must go back and retrieve what has been left behind in order to move forward. Did I get it right? I got it right. So when we think about our history, we cannot think about our history beginning with slavery as though that's where we first just magically appeared. You know, as though our story began in chains. Slavery was never our beginning. It was an interruption. Just like this is an interruption of my speech. We'll give it a moment. So long before European ships crossed the Atlantic, our ancestors governed kingdoms, built universities, had systems of law, practiced medicine, studied the stars, created complex systems of trade, raised families, honored elders, and passed knowledge from one generation to the next. Whole civilization. So when we're talking about emancipation and we're talking about freedom, we're talking about the disruption, the interruption of whole civilization. So the transatlantic slave trade, it was a violent interruption of all of those worlds. So many of us use the Swahili word ma'afa. Are anybody familiar with that word? I love it. We're connected. I told you, we should have connected ahead of time, but it's okay. And that basically means the great disaster. You know, this describes the catastrophe of what enslavement actually was. It wasn't just that millions of Africans were enslaved, but the entire system of knowledge, kinship, language, spirituality, and community was fractured for centuries. So the MAFA reminds us that slavery was never simply about forced labor. It was about attempting to erase a people's memory of themselves. That is why remembrance matters. Remembrance is resistance. And I like to repeat that. Remembrance is resistance. So when JC is here naming the names of the people who fought and created and dreamed on these very streets, that is a part of the resistance actively happening. So on Emancipation Day, we also honor the millions of names we do not know, because there's millions And I think about them every Emancipation Day. Anybody that knows me personally knows that it's a time for rest and to sit in reflection for those who were, you know, placed in bondage across the Middle Passage. 10 million lives lost. It's important for us to remember that's what we're talking about when we're talking about Emancipation Day as well. We're thinking about the mother whose children were sold away. Can you imagine the pain of that? You know, the fathers who resisted, even though they knew violence was going to befall on them, and the children who never knew freedom. You know, the ancestors who dreamed of a world they themselves would never live to see. So this year, the United Nations declared that the transatlantic slave trade was one of the greatest tragedies in human history. I won't mention which countries objected. I'm pretty sure we all know which three countries objected. There were several countries that also abstained, but in any case, the United Nations has declared it as one of the greatest tragedies in human history. So, considering that this is one of the greatest tragedies in human history, and yet, we're all here. When I look around, I see various shades of black and brown, all a part of this amazing heritage and story. So we survived, and we're here. And we have to remember that we are here because they survived and not because they accepted oppression, you know, which is why a thing that always irritates me, and I'm sure many of you have probably seen this online, where people will be talking about like current acts of racism that happen to black folks, whether it's in Canada or the US, and people will say, that couldn't be me, I'm not my ancestors. Has anybody ever seen those posts? I'm not my ancestors, I could never. I think out of all the things that I see in terms of the discourse online, that's one of the most annoying ones. What's up, Vanessa, I see you. That's one of the most difficult ones for me to process. Because if we actually had the strength and the courage and the resilience to just live through that level of terror, there's no way we could ever possibly say, I'm not my ancestors. They did not accept oppression, and we have to recognize that. Generation after generation, they fought in every way that they could. Some resisted openly, some quietly. Some escaped, some revolted. Some taught children how to read in secret. Some preserved songs, language, faith, recipe, names. Some simply made sure another generation lived long enough to continue the pursuit of freedom. And we have to never forget that. That is enough. That is a very significant act of resistance and freedom. So that resistance gave rise to emancipation that we're here celebrating today. And emancipation, it's not a gift. It was never an act of generosity. It was the culmination of centuries of resistance by enslaved African people, abolitionists, freedom fighters, revolutionaries, maroons, organizers, and ordinary people who simply refused to accept the absurdity that one human should own another. It is fitting that we're gathered here today in Kingston. You know, Kingston has often been celebrated as Canada's first capital, the military city. It's built through empire. But Kingston also reminds us that slavery was not simply an American story. It was a Canadian story as well. So long before Confederation, enslaved African people lived and labored in what would later become Canada. You know, the first documented enslaved African in what is now Canada, Olivier Lejeune, arrived here in the 17th century. Black history in Canada did not begin with the Underground Railroad, which is a story that we often like to tell ourselves, right? It sounds nice, it feels good, and it's very Canadian for us to think that the Underground Railroad, that's where it started. That's not the case. Enslavement was here as well. It includes slavery, colonialism, and dispossession. Again, it also includes resistance. And that truth matters. It's very important. Because when we tell incomplete histories, we inherit incomplete understandings of ourselves. You know, Kingston sits on Indigenous land. So before this city became a center of British colonial power, these lands were home to Indigenous people whose own experiences of dispossession reminds us that colonialism did not operate against one community alone. Kingston is often introduced, again, as the first capital. But today I invite us to think about Kingston differently. And I think JC actually did a fantastic job of that. Thinking of Kingston as a place where many histories meet. There's Indigenous histories, histories of enslavement, histories of migration, histories of resistance, and histories of community building. As Black people, we have never simply arrived in places just like Kingston and just not done anything. We've transformed them. You know, we've built churches where there were none. We established businesses. There's a lot of businesses over here. I hope everybody has an opportunity to check them out if you're enjoying the day. We created associations. We raised families. We organized. Kingston tells the story of Black Canada itself. Not because it's unique, but because it reminds us that wherever Black people have gone, we have insisted on leaving behind more hope than we found. Hope. I see your shirt. Hope. Right? We've left behind more hope than we found. This is what Black communities have always done. Wherever we've been scattered, we have found each other. So our histories may be slightly different than our Indigenous family members, but they intersect. Understanding emancipation also requires to understand the broader colonial project that reshaped lands, people, economy, and identities globally. Because history is never simply something I just study, it is something I feel I've inherited. And if you don't mind, I'd like to share a little bit more about who I am and how I even came to be here with you today. So, of course, it has to start with my mom. My mom's not here with us right now. She's actually waiting for my kids to come back from Caravana in Toronto. They're enjoying themselves on this Emancipation Day. But my mother came to Canada through the West Indian domestic scene. Are we all familiar with the West Indian domestic scene? A lot of people's people came through that method, right? In the 50s, 60s, she was one of several thousand young Caribbean women who arrived because Canada required her labor. You know, it's one of the greatest ironies, I feel, of colonial history. You know, after centuries of extracting wealth from Africa and the Caribbean, Canada continued to rely on Caribbean women to care for Canadian homes and Canadian children. Many of these women left behind children of their own. And not because they wanted to, right? But because economic survival demanded it. And when we think about the entire generation that came, and what we now later found out were called barrel children. Are we all familiar with the term barrel children? Have you ever seen, if you've gone past like an African or Caribbean grocery store, there's these barrels, they're about this high and they're usually blue? Usually they're blue and they're round and they're big. They're about this tall. Everybody's familiar with them? So in around the 60s and 70s, a lot of these young women who came from the Caribbean to Canada ended up having to send things back to their children back home. So they would stack these barrels with anything that you could think of, gifts, toys, books, clothes, canned goods, anything that they think the children would want. So these barrels now became attached to the children as barrel children. So the barrels, obviously, it carried more than just the necessities. I think about the guilt that those barrels also carried, the longing, the hope, the sacrifice, and the love. So my mother, like so many Caribbean women who came to Canada through the West Indian domestic scene, she made impossible choices. She left behind her family, her community, and the country she loved, believing that the sacrifices she made would create opportunity for her children that she herself hadn't been afforded. And as a child, I didn't really understand the economics of migration and the enduring reach of colonialism. I simply knew that every year there were barrels to be packed. You know, I remember tracing the outline. I don't know if anybody ever did this, if you had people that were back home and you would kind of see like the outline of their shoes, right? And you would use that to go and purchase shoes to send back home. And I used to love that part. That was my favorite thing to do when I was little. You know, I remember her carefully filling those barrels with clothing and school supplies and small gifts, ordinary things that somehow carried extraordinary love across the ocean. And then, of course, there were the trips back home. You know, every other December, we would leave behind the bitter cold of Saskatchewan. So I was actually born and raised in Regina, Saskatchewan. Are you from Saskatchewan too? You know where it is. Usually I scan the room to see if there's anybody, because it's very rare that there's anyone who's from Saskatchewan in places that I am. But you're from Saskatchewan? Where?
North Battleford.
I have not heard that name in so long. Big up yourself. So I'm from Regina. That's amazing. So you'll understand this when I tell this story then. So we were lucky as little kids, my sister and I. My mom would take us back to Jamaica every other Christmas. And I used to love it. And back then when the plane would land, it was landing on the tarmac, the door would open and this warm air would just hit you. And it just signaled to me, oh, like we're home. And I could see my mom just transform. This joy. Because remember, you're going from the Caribbean as a young woman. You're coming to Saskatchewan, right? You're isolated. There's very few Black folks. The community is small. So those trips home ended up signifying joy for my mom. And I actually could see it on her face. And I used to get excited just to see that happiness that she would have. So every other December, we would leave behind the bitter cold of Saskatchewan. And I remember when the plane doors opened and that humid air rushed in. But the main thing that I remember was the look on my mom's face. And I remember when we would get out of the area where you'd see all the people waiting for their family members, she would be looking out for her brother, my uncle Leko, who was always there to pick her up. And that, you know, that space that separated the passengers from the families that were coming home. And the warm embraces that they would have. I just used to love that. I still get emotional when I think about that, all that love. You know, as a little girl, I didn't have the language to describe what I was witnessing. Today, I understand it differently. You know, Jamaica became more than a place on a map. It became a place where I first learned that home can exist across time and place. It was warmth, It was family. It was belonging. It was the smell of food being prepared by hands that had nourished generations before us. But more than anything, it was the place where I saw my mother fully become herself again. You know, looking back now, I understand those journeys were acts of reconnection. They were moments of healing after years of separation imposed by economic necessity and the enduring legacies of colonialism. So while we recognize that colonialism separated Black families across the diaspora, our capacity to love one another across those same distances has never truly been extinguished. You know, this too is part of emancipation's story, because colonialism did not end again, as I mentioned earlier, when slavery ended. It simply found new ways to organize Black labor. And yet, our communities continue to build. If I can just take a moment to share a quick story about my late father, Norris Stacy, and my godfather, Colin Campbell. They understood that freedom required more than surviving. It required building. So in the 1980s, they established the Harambe program. I'm saying a bunch of words. Harambe is a Swahili word, meaning all pulled together. So the coming together, the bringing together. And this is long before institutions were even speaking the language of diversity, equity, and inclusion. We have to always remember, Black parents, especially during this time, and I know this was happening in Kingston as well, they were already doing that work. They were already speaking the language of equity, inclusion, belonging. This was what they believed. And we have to keep in mind that they belong to a generation shaped by extraordinary movements. Think about it. The civil rights is happening in the United States and Canada. Caribbean independence movements, anti-apartheid organizing, women's movements, indigenous sovereignty movements, and for queer and for trans liberation. They witnessed a generation insisting that another world was possible. That belief shaped how they raised us. Have to really, really give gratitude to those folks that really, really laid a solid framework for us. And when I think about experiences that I had and continue to have as a child, I witnessed these adults coming together in support of children. When we think about that now, when we think about how we're engaging as adults, for those of us that are adults here, who are also interacting and engaging with young children, are we doing it with the thought of carrying something forward, allowing the inheritance to move forward with them? This is something I think we all need to keep in mind. There were many instances as a child, because as I mentioned, growing up in a place like Regina, Saskatchewan, where there wasn't a large Black population, I did experience much of those really vitriolic examples of racism that were mentioned earlier as a child. And it was the adults that had to stand up and stop that from happening. And one thing we always have to keep in mind is that no Black child should really stand alone and have to be forced to have to reconcile with the horrors of racism. So looking back now, you know, I understand that what they gave me through the programming and the conversations and witnessing my mother going back and forth to Jamaica was much more than I even could have imagined. What they gave me was a framework for my life. They taught me that community is not simply where we gather when things are going well. Community is who shows up long before the institutions that are meant to protect us fail. And within the Canadian context, you don't have to look far to see disparities and disproportionalities showing up across systems and sectors. From education, policing, healthcare, child welfare, to see the ways in which institutions continue to fail us. Community is who reminds us your humanity is there when others attempt to deny it. So community is who stands beside you until you're strong enough to stand for someone else. And that lesson has stayed with me. And this is why I've tried to build spaces, and I'm very grateful to be able to come and engage and interact with all of you here today, because this is just a continuation of those lessons that I learned early on in childhood. And my hope is that for anybody that is thinking about starting a program, enjoys to share culture and loves heritage and these things, that you think about, if you've not started a program, think about starting a program, because it has the ability to shape the future. So it's really important. So when we think, again, I'm just going to come back if I digress. When we think about freedom itself, we often think about the dramatic moments, right? The breaking of chains, the signing of legislation, we think of big declaration, but oppression rarely disappears all at once. It adapts. It changes language. It changes institutions. It changes its appearance. But it continues to organize our lives in ways that are often invisible. That is why emancipation cannot simply be remembered. It must be practiced. So the key question that I would have for all of you today is, what does freedom require of us now? If you want to think about it, what does it require of us now? You know, as a researcher, much of my work examines experiences of Black children and families within Ontario's child welfare system. And for decades, we've known that Black children are disproportionately investigated, disproportionately separated from their families and disproportionately represented throughout the entire system. We know the stats, the reports, the commissions, the recommendations, they're all there, right? The question we have to ask ourselves, we know all of this, and yet why do these inequities continue to persist? And for many years, I've asked myself, you know, why? Why after decades of reform, of the conversations, why did the outcomes remain so stubbornly inequitable? And what I've come to understand, which I'm sure most of you have as well, is that systems are great at changing enough to preserve themselves. They adopt the language of equity. You know, we create the strategies, the committees, the frameworks, the working groups, the policies, mission statements, and all of those things matter. This is not me saying that they don't, because those things are all super important. But representation, it obviously matters, policy matters, race-based data matters, community engagement matters. But we have to keep in mind that representation alone does not guarantee liberation, because systems have an extraordinary way to absorb the language of justice without surrendering power. So representation may open the door, but liberation changes everything about the house, even the way it feels when you walk through the door or when you invite others to do so. And I think that distinction has been an important one for myself, because I have watched, and I know my good friend Nsenwa is there, and I know he's been working in child welfare for several years as well. I know Karen is here as well, who supports the One Vision, One Voice program. And I know that they would agree with me when I say, you've seen brilliant, passionate, deeply committed people enter institutions determined to create change. Right, Vanessa? We are determined to create change. People who carry their whole entire communities with them. People who understand injustice, not because they studied it, but because they lived it. People who are arriving believing that if they simply work hard enough, gather enough evidence, produce enough reports, if we remain patient, transformation will come. Sometimes it does, often it does not. Because institutions do not simply resist change, they reshape the people attempting to change them. Not all at once, slowly, quietly, meeting after meeting, compromise after compromise, until the person you entered full of purpose begins to question their own instincts, their own memory, their own voice, their own sanity. You know, many of us know that feeling. You know, some of us have lived it. I know I have. I know I have working in institutions, definitely have lived that. You know, I remember leaving meetings and having to question, did that really happen? Could that possibly have really happened? And you end up, right, you're laughing because it's true. And you end up questioning yourself so much that you end up not knowing, you know, truth from untruth. But we have to remember that that is the whole purpose. You know, we talk about the absurdity of racism. That is how it's designed in that way, right? To make us question. So that is why truth-telling is so important. You know, not because it's comfortable. I'm sure when I'm talking about the horrors and the tragedy of enslavement, many of you can think about the pain and the horror of it. It's not a comfortable conversation. It's not meant to feel warm and fuzzy, right? It is what it is. It is horrible. You know, that's the importance of truth-telling. You have to, because the inherited history continues to shape the way we move through the world today. So, some people walking by. So I will share one more story. I think I mentioned that both of my kids are off in Toronto right now at Caravana enjoying the festivities. One of my children, it's hard to say children, he's still a child to me, he'll always be. He just turned 18 this week. And I think about the way that I've attempted to raise him, both my husband and I. We've tried to keep that wondrous joy. And I know you guys are peeping them, you see them. There's a thing we talk about, black boy joy, right? And it's so important that we preserve that, in particular in young black boys. But it's really difficult to do as a parent. Because on one hand, you want to be able to make sure that they have that joyous wonder that is so important to their lives. But then you also have to try to prepare them for a society that isn't always going to treat them with the humanity and the dignity that they deserve. So for most of us who are parents to black children, we're always kind of in wrestling with this tug of war. It's really, really difficult and painful, to be quite honest, because you recognize that what you're doing could potentially not only just dim their light, but make them small, make them question their instincts, make them question who they are, which is what you don't want them to do as they're navigating this world. They have to know themselves. They have to know where they're coming from. They have to know where they're going. In order to do that, we have to only speak life over them while also warning them about the very real consequences of what it means sometimes to be a young black person in our society. And I'm going to speak on Nolan Wells right now, if you all don't mind, because as I was writing this speech, I couldn't stop thinking about him. You know, I couldn't stop thinking about how terrifying that must have been. And I know many details have not emerged, and it's still early on, but there's this theme that kept reoccurring when it comes to the conversation on Nolan Wells. And I don't know if anybody caught the discourse online. It was a conversation on whether or not, as Black people, we're meant to be alone in spaces. You know, people saying to their children, we always tell you, don't be the only one. Because to be the only one puts you in danger. And I wondered to myself as I was hearing that discourse online, if that was part of, in many ways, the inheritance that we've received from our ancestors before. Because I think about it, during the time of enslavement, during those times, I can imagine that there were Black parents who were always instilling the same messaging into their children. In the same way, I am trying to instill the same messages into my son, in the same way that I'm sure Nolan Wells' parents tried to instill into his young life before it was lost. But I think to myself how important it is for us to come together as collective. So when I think about our ancestors wanting to make sure we stay together, right? That we have those histories, that we have those stories, that we have ways to guide ourselves to truth and freedom. I think about Nolan Wells as well. I think about him constantly, and I hope that, you know, as you have time today and you're reflecting on Emancipation Day, you have an opportunity to also reflect on the impact that his life should have on us. Like, we should never really forget him. And there's many names that we could list, both within Canada and obviously the US, of names that we should never forget. And I want to say this, it's part of our inheritance, and I don't want it to land that our inheritance is one of fear, because it's not. You know, I think what it is, it's generations and generations of experience that have taught us that collective care is our greatest protection. It is our greatest protection. And then I remember my mother, my grandmother, and all of you, my godfather, my father as well, them trying to provide that collective care as protection. So generation after generation, Black parents have been asked to teach survival, oftentimes before freedom. And it's not because we lack hope. It's because we love our children enough to prepare them for the world that they're entering. So even in that reality, we continue to raise children who want to jump. Well, in my mind, they want to jump into the water. But we raise children who are able to dream, to laugh, to dance, to just be joyous. That is what we want, right? My love for our children is, I hope that you're able to connect with that through what we're speaking about today. Have you ever noticed how, I'm just going to like digress for a moment. Have you ever noticed how Black youth just bring this vibe and energy and this cultural like power? We recognize that, right? It is something that is fantastic and phenomenal and something that I think we need to celebrate more often than we actually do. So joy, for example, has always been one of our greatest acts of resistance. You know, it lives in our music, in our food, in the churches, in the mosques, in the temples, in Carnival, in Caravana today, you know, hoping the mass bands have a beautiful day. It's in family reunions and spoken word. It's in the dance halls. It's in steel pan. It's in reggae. It's in gospel. It's in Afrobeat. It's in soca. It's in samba. It's in laughter so loud that it can fill entire neighborhoods. Joy reminds us that oppression never gets the final word. So it's interesting because JC, I swear, JC was talking about the World Cup. And I had this whole thing talking about the World Cup because I was excited when the World Cup was happening because the conversations around colonialism. So you can imagine, I am like this all the time. Friends, family, it can be kind of daunting when someone wants to be talking about colonialism and freedom and liberation constantly. But I was excited about the World Cup because it actually gave an opportunity for us to actually have people who wouldn't necessarily talk about colonialism talking about it. You could actually see it playing out live and direct in front of us. So, like many others, you know, I found myself cheering for teams from across Africa and the Caribbean. And equally, I was obviously fascinated by another conversation that emerged. The amount of people that were talking about colonialism, about migration, about citizenship, about identity. You know, Haiti's story of resistance as the first Black Republic. They fought hard for that freedom, and they won it. But yet, throughout the World Cup, did anybody peep that they actually had to change their jerseys? Their original jerseys actually, you saw that, right? Was a recreation of them as the first Black Republic, and FIFA required that they remove that from their jersey. So still we see where that, like, the oppression plays out, right? You see how it actively is happening in our day-to-day. And then another thing that I was noticing is how many athletes represented countries whose histories are connected to empire. So sport in many ways became a classroom, which I thought was very cool. People found themselves asking questions about colonialism and its legacy. And it reminded me that liberation is never truly confined to one place. You know, liberation is in Ghana, it's in Jamaica, it's in Barbados, it's in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, it's in Sudan, it's in Haiti, it's in Canada. We're all connected. That's why I have so much love for this Pan-African flag. I have so much love for it because it represents all of the Black diaspora. So that is precisely, I believe, what Bob Marley understood when he wrote Zimbabwe. I'm going back to the beginning now. You know, he knew that liberation of one black community strengthens the imagination of another, because none of us are free in isolation. And today, that global connection remains painfully visible. So we know during hurricane season, and I have to say hello again to Msenwa, because this last hurricane season in October, where it was so devastating in Jamaica, and Msenwa and I were actually in a course together, and I was so distracted by the tragedy that was unfolding in real time, that I don't know if I would have been able to get through that course without Msenwa being there, just to acknowledge that, yeah, you're worried about your people back home, you're worried about what's to come, because if you're following the news and the media, it seemed like it was the world was basically about to end for Jamaica, and that was terrifying. But we recognize that the connection across the globe to the global north, the global south, injustice, it happens again and again. And I want us to think about when hurricane season comes around again, that many people, Black people rooted in the Caribbean, begin to brace themselves. You know, I remember one year it was St. Vincent, was the Bahamas, was Grenada, was Barbuda. Communities having to rebuild again and again. Within my community in Durham region, it has almost become routine. Like, we almost expect it, because we're made up of people from across the Black diaspora. So there's somebody who's connected and rooted to one of these islands, to one of these countries. So there's always this necessity to want to build and send things, whatever people might need. So we should ask ourselves why rebuilding has become so routine. Prime Minister Mia Motley from Barbados, you know, she's spoken about this at length, that climate change is not experienced equally. The decisions made in the global north have devastating consequences across the Caribbean and Africa. You know, the same regions that endured centuries of extraction now find themselves disproportionately carrying the burden of environmental crisis. So liberation, therefore, is also environmental justice. So it's economic justice, it's global justice, and it's environmental justice. And I wanted to acknowledge a few of the people that I know continue this work here in Kingston. Thank you, Suha, again, for inviting me to attend. Kibo, like, amazing. Oh, I did say I was going to say something in Afasi. That's it. That's all you've got. That's all. And, you know, obviously, Msenwa, JC, Paula, like, it's so amazing to be able to be alongside all of you here today. And I think what's most important is that when you do this work, you get an opportunity to be dedicated to truth-telling, community building, education, advocacy, and justice. Every generation receives freedom unfinished. Every generation must decide what it will do with the inheritance left by those who came before. So I want to speak for a quick moment, you know, to those who consider themselves allies, co-conspirators. You know, I've said this many times before, allyship is not measured by what you know. You know, it's easy to speak about anti-racism when everyone around you agrees. It is much harder when your voice may cost you something, when speaking up may affect your reputation, your promotion, your relationship, perhaps even your livelihood. Real solidarity has always involved risk. It asks you to remain present when it would be easier to disappear, to speak when silence would protect you, and sometimes to remain silent long enough to allow Black voices to be heard. You know, it does not mean abandoning your principles the moment pressure arrives. You know, I've watched some of the loudest allies, like over the years of doing this work, become the quietest observers when institutions demand conformity. And it's not because they were bad people. Many of them were good people, right? With great intentions and wanting to be supportive and wanting to be a great ally. But systems do reward compliance, right? So the question is not whether we understand racism. The question is whether we're prepared to confront it at a personal cost. That is the measure of solidarity. So I want to close now. How did I do for time, Kibo? Am I doing all right? Okay, good. So as I close, I want to return to where I began, which is to Bob Marley. Every man's got a right to decide his own destiny. You know, those words will continue to echo because they remind us that liberation is not the responsibility of one generation. It belongs to us all. Some of us will march. Some of us will organize. Some of us will teach. Some of us will write. Some of us will create policy. Some will become lawyers, entrepreneurs, artists, caregivers, researchers, public servants, musicians. I could keep, like, the list can go on and on and on. Some of us will simply love our children so fiercely that they grow up believing they deserve every opportunity this world has to offer. Every one of those gifts belong in this movement, because Black liberation has never depended upon all of us doing the same thing. It has always depended on each of us doing our thing in service of our people. Our ancestors did not all resist in the same way, so neither should we. What matters is that we resist, that we refuse to surrender our humanity. So on this Emancipation Day, let us remember that emancipation was never a destination. It's an invitation, an invitation.